Okay, good morning, everybody. Welcome to another New Energy Chinwag with Charlie Ratton and myself, John Massey. Morning, Charlie.
Good morning.
So this week, we thought we'd react a little bit to some events here in the UK from a policy perspective, and in particular, the news that the government have released a consultation document, which is due to be, the consultation ends in May. And basically, the exciting things on it are that onshore wind and solar both look as though they're going to have a chance to bid for the mechanism here, which is CFDs, contracts for differences, contracts for renewable power. And also there's a whole bunch of other bits and pieces in there around floating wind and around some of the handling of things like negative prices. There was a little bit on bioenergy to coal. There's various things in there, but I guess the things that have most hit the headline is particularly the fact that onshore wind and solar, which have been excluded from those auctions up to now, or sort of the last few years, might have a chance to get in there. So Charlie, I mean, obviously big impact. How do you see things going?
Yeah, firstly, I suppose it's welcome news for the wider renewable community. Obviously, we read the tea leaves, if you like, of these kind of things, and we knew that in the background, people were hoping that announcements might be made. We'd heard from the financial community, those involved in financial closes, that there might be some movement on, especially on onshore wind, which is one of the cheaper technologies. I think prices have plummeted in recent years, and it's been a source of contention. With Parliament calling a climate emergency and then excluding apparently the most effective means of perhaps getting there, so we'll wait and see the full details of it. But on the face of it, it's welcome news for the onshore wind community. Onshore wind has been largely restricted to Scotland in recent years, and we can perhaps tease out together some of the nuances. I would have thought that repowering would be especially well favoured. Sites are already there, but we can perhaps tease out some of the nuances. But I think to summarise, John, I think it's welcome news.
Yeah, and certainly, well, there's a few things in there. One was that solar and wind. I mean, the way the CFD works, for people that aren't familiar, and it's a long explanation, but I'll try and keep it short. It's up to now, it's worked in having what they call two pots. So pot one, which is for what they call established technologies, and pot two, which has been for less established technologies, which is included. That's how offshore wind, for example, has particularly grown going forwards. And so the idea really is now that into pot one, in those established technologies, solar and wind will be able to bid, which they hadn't before. Offshore wind, well, there's some part of the consultation around offshore wind is, in particular, there's some interesting stuff about separating out floating offshore wind from fixed offshore wind, and potentially either having them in the same pot, so bidding against each other, but as separate entities, so for separate contracts, or whether actually you have floating wind in its own pot, as, if you like, an emerging technology which requires a bit of protection from competing with its fixed counterpart, and obviously from things like solar and wind as well. So there's some interest. I mean, there's still, as I say, it's a consultation, so we'll see what happens in the end. But yeah, there's certainly the case that onshore wind, I think, is going to return, and solar will return, as you say, because they're cheap. I'll try and dig it out while speaking, but I mean, there are some numbers in there from the government as to what they expect some of the prices may be for these different things. And not surprisingly, both solar and onshore wind come in quite a bit below what they expect the market price to be. So I think that's the important thing to say is people often refer to this as a subsidy scheme, as we saw with offshore wind in the last round, which was when September, something like that. The prices that were contracts were being awarded for, the strike prices, were actually below what they expected wholesale prices, and in that circumstance they may actually end up not only not being subsidized, but actually paying money back to the government at because that's the way the CFD works. If you're selling in the market for higher than your strike price, then you pay money back. And so the same will probably be true of onshore wind and solar. And in fact, I've just found the prices as we talk. there's a chart in the document which talks about offshore wind, the future prices being around £45 per megawatt hour, onshore wind 34, solar PV 33. So, I mean, it's a quarter less for onshore wind than offshore wind. So yeah, I mean, if we can get them built, very cheap electricity, both for onshore and for solar. Again, there'll be some interesting dynamics. They'll be in the same pot, presumably, so they'll be bidding against each other. So it'll be interesting to see what capacity is built of solar versus onshore.
Yeah, quite a lot in there, John. Thanks for that analysis. A few things have happened, I think, that may be worth considering at this stage. Yeah, we talked about the post-subsidy world. We've discussed how the prices have fallen. But to do that, one of the big drivers has been bigger turbines, which I think may be significant as well. Offshore wind, we've seen big advances. We've talked in other podcasts about integrating schemes, hybrid schemes, how technologies can interact with each other. It's been a bit joined up thinking. Hydrogen's coming online. We've talked about battery energy storage. We've talked about integrating solar and other things that can all help. Of course, we've discussed in other podcasts how there are synergies between various technologies that, you know, you don't necessarily double the cost by doubling the nameplate kind of output figures. But I think the point I'm trying to make is that that the tech isn't the same as it was 4 or 5 years ago when a bit of a moratorium was put on in certainly south of the border. In Scotland, those that have prevailed have been much larger schemes, strategically sited schemes. The onshore wind industry has learned from offshore. I was involved in Isla. We put 202 metres to tip, but those are now being dwarfed. We're talking about 340, 350 metres to tip for offshore machines. And that trend obviously permeates now back onshore. But I think that's fanciful to think that that kind of tip height will be acceptable, whatever the pot, because For onshore wind, at least, obviously, you need your consent. And is there anything you'd like to say about on the planning side of things, however much the regulatory side might have gone and however much the pots might have been made available, whether the reality is, I think, only a third of onshore wind farms were going through at local level back in 2014 in England, and that's before the brakes were put on. So kit has got a lot bigger, and there's a bit more to it now. So even if the goals are available, it's going to be a tough call for onshore wind to react to that.
Yeah, no, I'd agree. And I think that's one thing that's not kind of been said enough when people have commented on this CFD announcement. It's all very well, as you say, them having a route to market in theory. But in practice, I still think it's going to be very difficult, particularly in England, to get these things consented, because the other policy change that was made a few years ago was to give local councils more and local stakeholders more power to stop these things. And so, again, that's going to be as big a hurdle as the economics. The economics, I don't think, are a major problem. There's a good wind resource. The kit is much cheaper. As you say, there's possibilities for things like hybrid projects and so on to reduce, increase the benefits, reduce the costs even further. But none of that helps in terms of actually doing the kind of things that you've talked about in the past of being on a wet Tuesday night in a room with a bunch of stakeholders trying to persuade them that they want these things on the horizon. So yeah, I think it's easy to get a bit overexcited about how much of a kickstart it will give in certain parts of the country, but potentially elsewhere in Scotland, particularly, you might expect to see a bit more development, I guess.
Yeah, and picking up on that theme, I think there are some smart things that the onshore wind industry can do. I think obviously some of the early onshore sites in the UK are now approaching 20 years old. They've long since paid off the, if they were supported, they've long since paid off the project costs, and developers will be looking at the sites. And as we know from bigger kit, fewer machines can often generate considerably more than lots more older machines. So you might have a reappraisal of some of the existing wind farms as they approach the end of their lives with a view to repowering. Whilst you're repowering, you might also look at some of the integration with other technologies that we've mentioned. When these wind farms were built perhaps 10, 15 years ago, there were no battery arrays, there was no integration with solar, there's certainly no hydrogen options available. A few other things have changed. People, kids are on the streets now. That wasn't the case 3 or 4 years ago. And a climate emergency has been declared. Parliament itself declared it. Cities on the back of that are declaring it. I think many local authorities are also declaring climate emergencies. And if that is the case, then it would look slightly hypocritical if a low-cost scheme designed to counter that climate emergency was presented and then rejected. It would be it would not play well for those that might sense hypocrisy at play. So I wouldn't get too despondent. I think the new generation of schemes will alert developers. So there are 3 or 4 big ones operating in Scotland. EDF come to mind, RES, Community Wind Power, a couple of others, E.ON and Energy are now linked together. They might be interested in this. But I think they'll look at the existing asset base, the existing operational wind farms, look at those that they're already considering. Were they due for a repower? Should they not just go for a completely revamped scheme at this stage? And there might be some dusting off of the archive of the portfolios of the things that they're already planning, and extensions as well, and then looking at things that have worked well in Scotland, augmented community benefits, a supply chain engagement, just like offshore, a sector deal is in place there where the supply chain is engaged at the earliest stage. So if you couple that with community benefits and local jobs and the bigger picture, and perhaps one thing also worth mentioning, you mentioned local authorities, but it's often forgotten that local authorities can benefit themselves. It used to be a conflict in the old days. You weren't allowed to become a generator if you were a state player, if you like, but now we can. A little commented part, I think it was under the coalition government that that was made possible. So local authorities, and I think this is happening in Warrington, can, and I think they've got a solar farm there, can become generators themselves, which might ease some of the tensions through. And I wonder whether more forward-thinking local authorities might be looking. I know that Liverpool's looking at Tidal, Anglesey, Wales, we've discussed elsewhere, whether local authorities might be looking at this and thinking, actually, rather than being a burden, this could actually be a real asset for the community.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. There's certainly, and there's local authorities that have become owners of battery systems as well. Certainly I agree that there will be more pressure, I guess, to grant consent going forwards, but I think there's still going to be issues around the right sites, about locations, about visual impact, all that stuff isn't going to go away. However much opinion polls say that people are in favour, there'll still be people on the ground who'll be against. But I think, as you say, it should be easier to get those things through. But I think it'll be about choosing sensible sites. I think, as you say, repowering will be interesting. There's nothing specific about repowering in the CFD. It would be an interesting idea as to whether that in itself becomes a specific category, or whether there will be some policy to support repowering going forwards, or to encourage repowering rather than greenfield sites going forwards. I think it will. You'll see regional patterns, I guess, as well. As I say, I mean, in markets like Scotland, you probably see a lot more wind. Perhaps down in southern England, you'll see solar rather than wind, both on a cost basis and also from the kind of visual impact of land use and that, and all the other issues that go around it. So, as a general point, I don't think the economics are not going to be the issue. It's going to be the length of time and the getting through the permitting side of it that will be interesting. I mean, there's also some of the other stuff in the CFD document. The consultation will also affect how these projects are built. There's some interesting stuff in there about negative prices. So at the moment, renewable power generators still get paid their strike price, so still get topped up to their strike price, even if the market price is negative, unless that is for more than 6 hours in a row, which is almost unheard of. We get a few negative prices, but 6 hours in a row is, I'm not sure it has ever happened. It certainly doesn't happen very often. But the forecast going forwards, as you add more of these things into the system, particularly if we end up with kind of 40 or 50 gigawatts of offshore wind in the next 10 or 15 years, is that negative prices will be more often. So that'll be a consideration. If you're not going to get paid at those periods, you'll have a choice to make. You'll either shut off because you don't want to give away your your electricity for nothing, or have to pay someone to take it. Or you consider other things like having storage alongside the project, save it to later and deliver it into the system when it's more valuable. So I think there are some of the things in the document that will also impact the kind of the planning, the design, the permitting, and all the other aspects of actually developing these projects as well. So I think we'll see some more issues around how these projects integrate better with the grid and with the system going forwards as well.
You mentioned earlier that floating is being considered in its own right. Would you like to expand a little bit more, and perhaps a little bit more on the implications of that for floating offshore wind?
Well, I mean, they've got two ideas, basically. One is that floating wind sits in the same pot as fixed offshore wind. So if you had an auction for a particular pot, particular set of technologies, floating would be bidding alongside fixed offshore wind. The other suggestion is that they pull out floating offshore into its own pot, and so treat it as a separate entity. So you could have either CFD rounds. Well, you'd have an auction that was specifically for floating offshore wind. I suspect, and again, this is a consultation, it'd be interesting to see what industry says. I'd be surprised if industry doesn't prefer the idea of floating having its own separate pot, given that in the early days, I guess it's going to be more expensive. So if it had the chance to bid, but not have to worry about competing on price with fixed or with other technologies, then that would be better. But it certainly suggests that from the government's point of view, they see floating as something they want to encourage. To me, that's the main takeaway from the consultation document, is that they see floating as something that they want to encourage. They want to help it to grow. They see it as strategically important, not just for UK waters, but as a opportunity for supply chain and all the stuff we talk about quite often, jobs, export opportunities, expertise, all that kind of stuff. So yeah, it's going to happen, certainly.
Yeah. I mean, we've discussed ScotWind, which is imminent in previous podcasts, and that is perhaps the next big test, if you like. Obviously, that will be now almost at the same time as the consultation. So we'll wait and see what is in place by the much delayed ScotWind process. And we've touched upon how some of the people that have developed a fixed kind of industry and not too thrilled at the prospect of then floating coming in and taking the spoils of perhaps ScotWind and perhaps future leasing rounds for the Crown Estate. We're up to round four there, but there'll be round five, round six, round seven. I know that people like Cornwall, the South Wales, they're all already starting to make the early signs. This is the new sign of the energy, the offshore energy strategy in place, and the sector deal. With people now already engaging potential supply chain. The supply chain going forward isn't necessarily the supply chain that's in place now, or the supply chain that's taken some of the pain for developing the offshore wind industry. So we'll watch out how that plays. One thing that did strike me, we've seen big scale nuclear being ramped back in recent years, but there is still this idea of smaller scale, these micro nuclear facilities being placed on large sites. Is there anything in the CFDs regarding nuclear? Is that out with of the of that support mechanism?
Yeah, no, there's nothing in there for nuclear, and even the nuclear thus far has not really been. I mean, Hinkley has a CFD contract, but it was never a contract that was in a kind of competitive open auction. You can download it in heavily redacted form.
Right. Okay.
Right. Nuclear will be separate. So I mean, the government they're putting money into. I think they put some money into a scheme with Rolls Royce around developing these SMR, small modular reactors. Yeah. I think the expectation is that you're talking about kind of 2030. At the earliest, before one of these things might be sitting on a skid somewhere developing electricity. I think nuclear is certainly something the government are still keen on. So beyond Hinkley, Sizewell C and Suffolk is the kind of next one along the line. If they can get anyone to stick the money in and they can agree a a scheme that will actually make it economic. But obviously, I mean, the challenge for nuclear is that in terms of cost, if we're talking about costs for so onshore wind and solar being down at whatever I said earlier, kind of 30 odd pounds per megawatt hour. I mean, Hinkley was up at 92 pounds per megawatt hour. So it's hard to see. There's not really an economic case for generating electricity with nuclear at the moment. That's the big challenge. So for government, it's to what extent they're prepared to put money behind a strategic goal to keep nuclear as part of the mix, I guess.
Yeah.
But it's not mentioned in this current CFD, certainly.
No. Coming back to onshore wind, which we started today's analysis, and I'm just trying to tease out some nuances as to which way the industry might go forward. I would imagine that those who are still developing in Scotland would be interested and they might be looking. I would imagine those with existing portfolios, E.ON and Innogy's, they're now combined, and others that have got existing fleets would also be interested. I suspect that, as I say, will go more for rather than fresh site. I mean, the wind industry is over 20 years more where the big sites are in the UK, and obviously housing has developed, tip heights have gone up, so a lot of them will have fallen away by the wayside, but they will not know. And the Scottish Energy Strategy and the Scottish guidance is quite useful with the large strategically sited areas, and then move the kit away from communities at least, so that the landscape and visual element is reduced. And then perhaps be a little bit clever in not necessarily going for the maximum tip height, but I do know that I think 167 meters buys you 7 megawatts as a machine, and that will certainly fly through most project hurdles. And that's come from offshore. That's come directly from offshore. That machine size was tested at 6 and now it's 7. And I would have thought 167, if you sighted it carefully, would be acceptable, certainly as part of a carefully calibrated repowering scheme, of which there are some fairly sizable ones, even in England, some quite close to me. The Scout Moor one was the biggest in England when it was built, 66 megawatts. It sounds small now, but it's only 10 years old. Sooner or later, somebody will look at, well, what we're going to do with that going forward. Are we going to put some blade extensions on and increase the swept area? Are we going to raise the height of it? Or do we have a look at the whole lot of it, remove some of the turbines, if you like, from the edge to the middle, fewer turbines, but with bigger generators and double, and then perhaps think, should we add a bit of, this is Lancashire, so I wouldn't necessarily think of solar, but you might be looking at other battery arrays or even trialling a bit of, if you've got the developers might be part of the hydrogen network trials going on here in the northwest of England. Should we trial something on that? Is there a little bit of seed funding available to put something in the middle? And so that's the way that my train of thought goes with regard to the announcement south of the border. John, is there anything that you'd like to add to that?
No, I mean, I think that's it's covered most of it. I mean, it's other than what we've covered, I mean, as I say, I think I don't think the economics are a big deal. The importance of the CFD is less around the price and subsidising the price. It's more about having certainty over a length of time. It's about having a 15 years of knowing what your revenue is going to be. So I don't think the economics are difficult. It's going to be about site selection. I mean, I guess the normal things around grid. Grid as well will come into play, grid congestion, grid access, that kind of thing, which again is where things like battery potentially help solve that problem or mitigate that problem a little bit. I guess one thing we've not mentioned is timescale. I mean, they were talking about having this, the consultation ends in May, which I guess means that they'll sort of announce what they're designing to do in the summer. I think they were talking about having these auctions as soon as next year, as soon as 2021. So I guess then you're from time frames to actually getting onshore wind farms up and built. What are we talking about, another 2 or 3 years after that?
Yeah, I think they streamlined that process. I mean, obviously, the first ones, it depends on how bold the developers want to be. Do they want to push the boundaries and know that they're going to go to appeal straight away? That they're going to, I mean, only a third were going through at local level. But suddenly, if you go to appeal, suddenly you go up to two thirds. Now, I would imagine if you're serious about going to net zero by 2050, it must start feeding into the planning system, certainly with regard to PINs and the planning inspectorate and stuff like that. Say, well, this is an overarching national remit, and that will then feed in. So even if the local community is not too happy, although they'll be mollified if you have done all the things with local jobs and community benefits and so forth that bigger schemes can perhaps fund. So the pudding is perhaps going to be in the eating on this one. I would imagine it will be of interest to the utilities, those that are on existing fleets. And it's a strange space onshore wind in the UK. I mean, you had certainly had a strange mix of SMEs, you had family firms and the utilities all in the same space, which was very, very unusual. The smaller outfits had local support and very agile. The utilities were excellent on things like health and safety and project financing and that kind of thing. So it was a very unusual space, certainly in the outset. Since then, obviously, it's much more industrialized, much bigger kit. But it might not be wise just to go for the biggest tip height. I think it needs a little bit of an art as much as a science, and be mindful of what communities are telling you. If communities are telling, well, absolute tops is 170 meters, then don't say, well, I'm going to stick a 230-meter bit of kit because it's going to wind people up.
Do you think, given the lack of action for the last few years, do you think there's also some issues around getting started up just in terms of practical things like, I don't know, people, trained staff?
Yeah, it's a good point, because actually, offshore, the glamorous sibling is offshore wind, and that is sucking the resources. Most of us who did develop in offshore wind started off on onshore wind. And so are you then going to start training up a new cohort to develop this? First of all, I think people are going to be a bit cautious. Yeah, it's all right to have the policy, but let's get a couple of test projects into the planning system and see what happens and see how smooth that flows. And then resourcing, you could argue that, I suppose, renewables is almost cannibalizing itself. I think you were hinting at this in your earlier analysis, that you're up against other renewable schemes, bizarrely. Yeah. So you might have this this great wind farm, but you might be up against an even better solar scheme. So that might scare. So we don't know. I mean, the idea of reducing costs through auctions is perhaps a good one, but it can have unintended consequences. Mm. And does we talk about it, but I suppose the government's shown willing. But I suspect it'll be a little bit more nuanced when it comes into reality, that most of it will perhaps work around perhaps extensions to existing schemes, repowering, then a whole batch of fresh sites that nobody's ever considered. I think that won't happen for a whole heap of reasons.
No, but certainly, having been dormant for a couple of years, it's not, I think that's an important issue, is you've not got people that can suddenly spring out of the woodwork and start doing these things because they're doing other things. So I guess that will be, there'll be some issues. I suppose because I think it's fair to say, I think industry probably saw this coming, or they've certainly been lobbying quite hard for it for a few years. So I think some of the bigger players, I suspect they've not been doing nothing. They're not starting from scratch. They've probably already got stuff sort of on the go or in the pipeline in anticipation of this coming up. I guess time will tell as to how quickly industry can react to a decision when it happens and then actually get on with it.
Yeah, a few things will fall out of it. First of all, not all current sites are suitable for repowering. They're quite constrained already, so you're not going to get the existing sites just so they're massive machines. It doesn't always work like that. Yeah. So you might get some kind of consolidation where the bigger sites, your industrial scales, utility scale sites, are the ones which prevail because they've got you mentioned about the land use earlier, and I think that's important, how you can fiddle around and do some wriggle room analysis, and you can shuffle around in relation to stakeholder feedback. You've got the tools. It's much easier than it used to be. Some of us remember when it used to be a kind of drawing kit. You know, you're drawing circles on maps with pencils in the early days of wind, and things have moved on. We've talked about GIS. You've talked about 3D mapping, visualization. There's a whole heap of very smart kit out there that can speed and inform the stakeholders. So it'll be quicker. Like you say, I think the constraints might come from unexpected sources. But as you also indicate, I don't think that there would have been quite such a long prolonged. We both follow the tea leaves. We knew it was happening, perhaps not the detail of it. But that's happened because people want it in the industry. Mm. And so it'll be interesting to see now who rises above the parapet to be the first mover. And whether it's the same people that also develop offshore, because they perhaps spot synergies as well. So maybe some of these sites, we've mentioned that offshore wind, for example, has got an onshore element. Well, would it be smart to do something around that as well? I mean, you've already looked, you've already done your searching of your sites and your land use analysis. Perhaps that would be a location, especially if you've got storage built into the scheme as well. That might be a smart move.
Yeah, and if you're upgrading or building substations and so on, grid connections, then yeah, it would certainly make sense. It would reduce some cost to plug an onshore wind into the same one at the same time. So yeah, no, that's an interesting idea. See whether there'll be some sort of integrated on and offshore wind farms coming on stream.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds perhaps a little bit fanciful, but we've got this, is it splendidly titled Backwind? I'm not sure what the latest is. I mean, the concept isn't completely new to the industry. And of course, there are new players offshore. They've not all developed onshore. They've not perhaps gone through the pain that those of us started onshore. And they might just come with a bit of fresh thinking as well, and a bit of heft behind it as well. So that's one thing that springs to mind. And the other thing, of course, is where interconnectors come in. I'm always interested in, you know, the grid always looks at 10-year upgrade plans and all this kind of stuff. They've got a strategic vision, and there might be some smart thinking looking at some of that. And of course, that's exactly what developers do. They think strategically and look what the longer term options are. But it is a statement of intent, as we said right at the outset, and it will filter down, and perhaps it will, God forbid, if it was to filter into the local planning system, where the local planning authorities make the decision. But with a bit of guidance, we watch that space, I suppose, with interest.
Yeah. No. I mean, I think I think we both identified that's the key. It's all very well being able to have a contract to sell your electricity, but it's getting permission and kind of social license and all the other things to actually build the project are going to be the key hurdles to get over. So yeah, that's obviously a key next step, is how, to what extent has that been solved, or what extent are the government going to help out on that as well. So yeah, it wouldn't surprise me if there are other announcements to follow. Is there anything you think, given this is a consultation, are there any other things that you think industry will throw into the consultation?
Well, we've already mentioned the cost reduction, and that's always the biggie, isn't it? The bottom line is of great interest. I think you mentioned that we're in a post-subsidy environment now, so that's not the issue that it was, and strange things are happening out there. We've got cities are interested in getting net zero. You've got EVs that you've mentioned. You've got people on the streets. I think people are now realizing, certainly those of us in the north are well aware of flooding and things like that. It seems to be a regular occurrence, so I can't see that going away any time soon as a driver. Other drivers are things like clean air, which it plays quite well in, and a local chance to build a local industry as well. So we've seen that from offshore wind. There's a whole heap of drivers that are perhaps more favourable than they were 4 or 5 years ago, when other constraints were in play. But obviously, from an investor point of view, onshore wind is not. And it's a mature tech. The cost of borrowing has also come down. And as we've said elsewhere, including here, that it integrates quite comfortably. The variability, the intermittency issue that plagued it in the early days is melting away a bit as well. So the energy trilemma piece is perhaps less potent as a stick to beat renewables with than it perhaps was as well. So it's an interesting timing, and we'll see, I suppose, now. We've covered a lot, I think, of the issues in this podcast, but we'll see which elements gain traction and which elements fall by the wayside, yeah?
Yeah. I mean, how these things normally work, I think normally the submissions to a consultation are normally available. And they're normally published either by the individual stakeholders, or I think also on the government
what
website.
What usually happens is when you do, because I have done a number of these consultations, you get an option and you can say, do you want your views public? So you click one button. Or do you want to do it in private? And the private ones are not the ones that you see. Yeah. So, but you do see some of it, and obviously you'll see the main arguments, you'll see the thrust of it. So perhaps we can return during the summer and perhaps pull a few of the key points off the consultation and share our views on them.
Given that it's a two-way process, it would be interesting to see what industry throw into the mix, whether there's any kind of curveballs that arrive from the industry side. The government's she set out what it would like to do, but it'd be interesting to see what pros and cons industry come up with.
Strange consultations will melt away. Certainly in Scotland, some of the bigger landowners were very anti-wind, but that's perhaps less the case now. I've even seen consultation responses from things like the coal industry, very hostile to wind, and yeah, perhaps that isn't going to be the case going forward as well. And I've noticed in offshore now, the one in Barrow, for example, is called the Offshore Energy Alliance. It's not called the Offshore Wind Alliance. Mm. So I think that renewables is bringing sister tech. It's not seen as an absolute rival or enemy so much now. It's seen as something that perhaps we can harmonise with and work with other industries. Do you remember that phrase, sector coupling, that came from somewhere? Well, there's more talk of that as the industry is much more grown up now, and perhaps some of the adversarial approach which plagued schemes, issues with airports, issues with lighting, perhaps those to an extent been at least resolved, this tech that can solve some of the issues that weren't the case a few years ago. So it might have less of a landscape of visual impact than might have previously been the case. That's the kind of thing I'd look for developments on, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, interesting.
I think we'll monitor this, and hopefully listeners will feedback on what they would like us to cover. But I think onshore wind is now back on the agenda in south of Bud, and obviously John and I both track the industry pretty closely. So we'll try and keep you up to date as to what's happening on that sphere.
Yeah, and solar as well. See what I mean. So there's been some solar happening anyway. That's not completely ground to the halt south of the border, and particularly solar plus battery. There's quite a few solar projects who are making the case, even without having a CFD, either corporate PPAs selling into the market, but with batteries and grid services as a big part of their revenue stream as well. So again, it'll be interesting to see if that's something that wind developers start to add.
Yeah, and even in Scotland on the east side, there's perhaps a somewhat surprising solar resource. I think we heard from Lincoln Blevians, didn't we, last week on how that's happening and playing out in California, and that solar isn't what it was 10 years ago. Just like wind, people have added bits, and sometimes people have added bits retrospectively, but sometimes if you design things in from the start, you can come up with a really slick scheme that does pass some hurdles quite easily.
Yeah. Okay. Probably leave it there then. We'll probably return to it certainly in the late spring, early summer, once the consultation's finished, see what the actual outlook seems to be. If you're looking at onshore wind and you're interested in the UK, then the good news is it's probably going to start happening again, which would be handy given the resource we've got and given the cost being low. The same for solar. And if you're interested in other things like floating wind, then maybe some brand new opportunities starting to appear in the future. So yeah, plenty happening.
Yeah, thank you, listeners, for being with us as we talked our way through onshore wind today. We always look forward to hearing from our listeners. If you've got any suggestions that you'd like us, John and I, to cover in future podcasts, please drop us a line, and we'll do our very best to tease out the nuances of that particular sector.
Yeah. Okay. Well, goodbye for today.
All right.